The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
Okay, this is class 17, and we still have to finish some things on foraging behavior, and then we'll go into anti-predator behavior today. Reasons why foraging in a group, at least for herbivores, may be better for an animal than foraging alone. And there's two main reasons. There are additional reasons also when we deal with at least additional anti-predator, but I've listed two major ones for protection from predators. If you have more animals, more likely that one of them will notice the predator. And also, if you're in a group, the predator can only usually attack one, so the chances you'll get caught are less. That's the selfish herd effect. The second one is directly related to feeding. You have a much more likely chance of detecting food sources. Of course, that's important. If food sources are hard to find. Many of you have seen birds foraging in flocks, but they do it more at certain times of year. What time of year do you see more flocks of birds? Remember, birds, unless they're preparing to migrate, are generally feeding. If you see them. Okay, so you do see flocks of birds that migrate in groups. But when are you most likely to see foraging birds? Yes? When? In the winter, that's exactly right. And if you haven't noticed that before, just pay attention to it this winter and you'll see birds that other times of year are in very small groups or just by themselves foraging singly. You'll see foraging in groups because it's much more likely that one of them will see the food and then they'll all converge on it. Of course, then they have to compete, but better to take your chances of competing for some food than not finding food at all. Does the same reasoning apply to carnivores in their hunting behavior? Well, if they're also preyed upon, then that might be important. Some predators, though, don't have other predators, except for humans. What about detecting food sources? Well, that could be important if food sources are scarce. So yeah, some of the same reasons will apply, at least some of the time. But in addition, when we're dealing with predators, we have other advantages of group hunting involving active cooperation among different animals. Many of you have seen films of these animals. These are just the ones that immediately occurred to me. But I've seen group hunting in lions, wolves, and wild dogs. Those, of course, are fairly related. Genetically, killer whales and humpback whales. The book, your text, the Scott text, talks about the humpback whales, the so-called bubble cloud feeding, where one of the whales, rather than joining the group attacking the fish, will produce these large bubbles, make a cloud of these bubbles, and that tends to repel the fish. And then the others will come in from the other directions and move the fish towards that bubble cloud. Then when they're dense, then the quails will swim right through them and grab as many as they can. So it increases the number of fish they can catch in a short time. It wasn't clear to me from what he implied, Scott implied, that the whale creating the bubbles doesn't get any fish. I'm not certain that's always true. But we know that whales, what's the other thing that would help the whales in a situation like that? We just talked about it last time, the fact that they can communicate with each other. They're like humans in that respect. They have a lot of different calls. They maintain their group cohesion and they even convey information. Exactly how much information, we really don't know. Killer whales are a small carnivorous whale. They will attack larger whales, but they can succeed only because they do it in groups. African wild dogs will chase down usually herbivore hoofed animals, herbivores. They're much more like, they're a fairly small animal, bringing down a much larger animal, so they don't stand too much of a chance. There's only one of them doing it. But when there's many, then the chances that the herbivore will get away are very small. The same is true for wolves. What do Canadian, the wolves in northern Canada feed on? Yeah.
Elk.
That's right. Elk and some occasionally moose, but mostly elk. The reindeer is one of them. It's a variety of elk. And they're specialized in their hunting behavior for that. And lions, much smaller groups, usually a lion's within a pride, usually a couple of females, occasionally a male will deign to participate. but there you see very smart behavior because one of them will, for example, flush the animals where the others will hide, and when the animals are flushed, they will be driven in the direction of the animals that are ready for the ambush. We don't really know if any of the big lizards called dinosaurs did that, although in Jurassic Park you see that depicted among the velociraptors. Okay, what do we mean by the term optimal foraging? I want you to make sure you understand that. It's been used in models, quantitative models. Basically means what animals have to do to maximize net energy intake, which means the energy they can take in a given amount of time. So what they're trying to enter, now that means net energy intake. So you've got to subtract from that the amount of energy they expend. Okay. The costs of their behavior. So, consideration of optimal foraging has helped us understand why crabs choose to feed on intermediate-sized mussels more than on large ones, even though the large ones have a lot more meat. Why? Because the large ones are a lot harder to break open, take a lot more energy. And the small ones are easy to break open, but they don't have as much meat. So as predicted by this kind of model, they optimize. They feed mainly on the intermediate size if all of them are available. Now, it doesn't mean they will never. They're perfectly capable of breaking open any of these different mussels. And they do, but they you just look at the frequency that they're eating, the different sizes, they will pick the intermediate size ones. It has been a little harder to understand in the terms of this model why the among marine iguana, why the large ones will feed subtidally, which means usually at high tide or at low tide further out, okay, but under the water, okay, so spending quite a bit of time under the water and they're feeding, whereas the small ones will feed between the tides on the exposed beaches. Why is that? Because the small ones are not as good a swimmer, and also because they're small, they lose body heat more rapidly in the cold water where these animals feed, so it's more costly for them to feed subtidally. And only when they're bigger do the benefits of feeding subtidally begin to exceed the costs enough so that they'll undertake that alternate method. And the last example is the foraging birds, the red shanks. These are the animals that feed near the ocean shore on large worms. On worms, they prefer the large ones. But they visit. If they find a patch of large worms, you won't find them all there. They do visit the other patches. So what would be the answer to that question? Why do they visit the various patches, some of which might be a lot less productive with the large worms? It's basically to get this kind of model to work. Of course, the animal has no idea of the model, but he's inherited these tendencies. He needs to sample the different feeding grounds. He has to know what's available. And for all he knows, you know, there's a lot of birds feeding in the one area. Pretty soon the large worms are gone. When he detects that the large worms are diminishing to a certain extent, then he will go to another area. And so the more he knows about the other areas, the more quickly he will realize that he should move. Okay, so it benefits him to spend a little of his time visiting the other areas. But it's all pretty clear in terms of this model. Now, related to that is the idea of the ideal free distribution. That is, animals that are feeding in groups let's say a new animal is coming to join groups of foraging animals, and if there's a lot of animals foraging in a very rich patch, sometimes the animal will in fact go to a less rich area. And to explain that, they've measured enough of this kind of behavior, the density of the birds and the nature of the food they're feeding on, to figure out that there is a problem with too many animals feeding in one patch because of the depletion. There's only so much food per animal in the group. And if the group's too large, then maybe the less dense, less rich patch is better in terms of how much that one bird will be able to get in a given amount of time. So, as a result, the animals tend to distribute themselves in an optimal way, so they avoid excessive competition. It's beneficial for them to have evolved that tendency in order to maximize their food intake. So that's the IFD, the ideal food distribution. And it can be predicted from simple quantitative terms of the animals and their prey. Obviously, foraging animals are faced with conflict all the time if there's predators around. Should they keep eating or should they hide? If there's a lot of predators around, they spend all their time hiding, they never eat. So there's a big problem. Quantitative studies have shown that if you have a group of foraging fish and you add a predator, like you have small fish fed upon by trout, and you add a trout to the tank where you're studying them, their feeding will go down. But the amount it goes down will depend on how hungry they are. In other words, the hungrier they are, the greater likelihood that they'll take a chance of not being caught by the predator. If they're pretty full of food, then of course it makes more sense to reduce the chances of predation immediately and hide. Okay, so that's all I have on the foraging. I want to go. Sure.
Does the animals distribute itself more distributed? Does it mean that the humans were trying to obtain sustainable growth? Are they distributing the same thing that the human to sustainable growth, the same thing as?
I don't quite understand what you're saying. You're talking about human behavior.
Yes, human behavior is that we are working on to try to control population.
Oh.
To find,
population size controls are another matter. These models are not developed with that in mind at all. Okay? So just forget that. It is related, I agree. Because if you have too many animals, then the optimal distribution may be suboptimal for everybody.
Okay. Well, I don't know whether intentionally have less kids, but I realize that
they're less. That's right. There are natural mechanisms of population control that have evolved, and this has been studied, for example, in rats, letting them become overcrowded, and I believe in mice, and I'm not sure what other species, but there have been several, a number of studies like this. Rats, for example, develop problems. They have enlarged adrenals. Their fertility goes down. Okay. Their irritability goes up, as you might expect. Their immune systems become less functional. They get sick more often, so more of them die. These are believed to be population controls, although there's argument about how that would evolve. Because obviously, you can't say that it's benefiting any individual to die for the sake of the group. On the other hand, if some of them don't do that, they'll all die. You know. But it is an important issue. I'm glad you brought it up. Okay. But that's not related to these models. That wasn't part of the consideration. Obviously, to develop a model like that, you have to simplify the situation enough. You have to make certain simplifying assumptions to make it work. And it usually works pretty well, and these models have predicted these behaviors I described pretty well, as others as well. Okay, talk a bit about anti-predator behavior. What's the difference between primary and secondary defense strategies of prey animals? Primary defense means avoiding detection, avoiding being attacked. And secondary means that's what you fall back on if you are attacked. How do you reduce the chance that the attack will succeed? Or if you get grabbed, how do you reduce the chances that you'll be killed? That's all secondary defense strategies. Okay, what's the main thing we can think of immediately without having this class about primary defense strategy. Avoid being detected. Camouflage, yeah. That's the most obvious one. There's another number of others. But a camouflage is a good example of a primary defense strategy. What's a good example of a secondary defense strategy?
Poisonous
skin. But the problem with that is the first animal may die. Okay, but in fact, it benefits the others. Again, the problem is figuring out how that evolved, but it did evolve many times. Animals, if not skin, other, at least parts of their body are poisonous. I think that'll come up again here in a minute. This is a means of avoiding, of camouflage, really, counter shading. What does it mean? If you look at most fish, at their bodies, if you catch fish, then you know this. Bullheads, for example, that are living in fairly muddy ponds or near the muddy bottom of a pond, they're dark on the top, but if you turn them over, they're light. What advantage is that? That's counter shading. Well, when they're seen from above, you're seeing them against the dark bottom, so they want to look dark, so they don't have the contrasting profile. If you're looking up at them, or predator is looking up at them, of course the surface of the water is very light, so they want to appear light. Well, then why would cephalopods need a counter shading reflex? What is it? What good is it? What is it that cephalopods do and the ability they have that this question is referring to? Yeah.
Like sometimes like rotate their bodies?
Yeah, exactly. They shift around a lot, and so they can shift the part of their body that's dark and the part of their body that's lighter. And they can do it with amazing speed. Okay, but it appears to be a reflex connected to their otolith organ, their vestibular system. So they're always adjusting, they're counter-shading. So they won't get caught by a predator. And octopus, especially when they're smaller, but also when they're bigger, are caught by predators. More about octopus here, and squid as well. Many predators develop search images by perceptual learning. They learn what prey to attack, what is good prey. So they develop the ability to recognize them. And they attack familiar animals. So how does the octopus and squid counter that ability? By changing. They change, some of them remarkably often. So there's no way that a predator can even form a consistent search image of an octopus or squid because they're changing all the time. If they form a search image because they caught one that looked one way, it's unlikely they'll find another one very soon that will look similarly. They can change the coloration of the bits of their skin. What is Batesian mimicry? It's related to this idea of a search image. For Batesian mimicry, the one that we all learn about when we're kids in grade school is the monarch butterfly. Tastes really terrible, which you were mentioning before. And other species have evolved a mimic of that of the monarch butterfly. is one that they often show, and you really can't tell it from a monarch when you first see it. If you look at many details, you'll be able to tell the difference and know they're different species. Okay. That species evolved, obviously, after the monarch evolved. It evolved this bad disappearance, even though it doesn't have the bad taste. By mimicking the monarch, it avoids predation. There's other examples of that. That's Batesian mimicry. It's only mentioned briefly in the text, and he doesn't mention the monarchs. Okay, he talks quite a bit about plovers that are ground nesting birds. They nest in areas that are relatively open. That makes them fairly conspicuous to predators. What advantage does that have for the plover or other ground nesting birds? There's quite a few ground nesting birds that do. It always amazed me when I first learned about these kinds of birds. Why would they just make a nest on open ground? They're so easy to see. Yeah. Well, that's an advantage of living on the ground. But you could still live on the ground and be more hidden. The advantage, at least one advantage we can name, is that if they're easier to see, the predators are easier to see by them. Okay? So the adult plover will never get caught by a predator because if he's alert, if he's sick, he might. But if he's alert, he will always see the predator come because he's nesting pretty much in the open. I mean, there are obstacles around there, but he's the animals that would hunt birds of this the size of a plover are big enough that they won't be hidden by the small things around plover in plover nesting country. Okay? So what then do they do if there's a fox or a polecat that's approaching? What it's concerned about here is not its own safety, but the safety of its eggs or young. And the plover is perhaps the most remarkable because one of its methods of saving its nest. The book lists four different strategies. Like the plover will shift his position to another place somewhat distant from its nest. Okay? And act like it's nesting there. And it will wait till the fox or the polecat gets very close. Then it will fly up, okay? And the fox will dash in, expecting it to get the eggs or the babies. And of course, it won't find any, so it starts looking frantically around and eventually has to give up because there aren't any. The bird will, there's other strategies it can follow too. It depends perhaps on how far she was able to get away once she detected the polecat, and they're pretty good at detecting them. So often they see they have quite a bit of time before the polecat gets there, and before the polecat can see their nest or their eggs. They might actually attack the polecat. They'll literally fly at them and startle them. But that's a distractor to make them lose their, keep them from focusing on the real nest. And again, the plover is very fast, it can fly, the predator, of course, can't, and these aren't aerial predators we're dealing with, these are ground predators. The other two are the ones I like the most. if there's grass in the area, and there often is, short grass, but enough to partially hide at least the plover, they'll go scurrying off through the grass, squeaking like a rodent. And the fox suddenly thinks, aha, a tasty rodent, chases it. When he gets close, of course, the plover flies. And by that time, the plover has led the fox quite some distance from the nest. So he's protected young. She's protected her young. The other one is the one we hear about the most, and that's the acting like they're injured. They'll go flopping away, and they'll do this when the predator's pretty close. Okay, they want to present it with an object to attack that they can't resist, and that's a bird with broken wing. And it's so good, the imitation is so good, that many people have been fooled by it. You see this bird flopping along, you know, holding its one wing in an awkward position. Looks just like a bird with a broken wing, and it's squawking, you know. And so the fox or polecat, they have fixed action patterns too, and they can't resist going after that bird. And of course, as soon as they attack, the plover suddenly becomes a healthy bird. By that time, it's been led quite a distance from the nest. So those are the four strategies that are mentioned in the book, and they're all quite interesting. Shows that the bird is not totally defenseless, even though it's nesting on open ground. Now here we're really dealing with a secondary defense, which means reducing the success of an attack. And many of you know about this also. A chick caught in the jaws of a predator sometimes won't be killed. It's because predators often don't immediately kill their prey once they're sure they have control of it. They'll injure it or hurt it and drop it and go after others. After all, if it's a chick, there's got to be brothers and sisters nearby. So if the chick acts like it's already dead, okay, there's a good chance he'll be dropped without further damage. And so the chick can avoid being killed, at least at that time. And there's two fixed action patterns involved. The first, of course, is the stimuli of being grabbed in the mouth of the predator, which elicits this playing dead phenomenon. And it's an amazing phenomenon. I've observed it in hamsters. Their breathing slows down, their heart rate slows down, they become very immobile. And frozen for a pretty long period of time. I don't think in the hamster it plays the same role as it does in this chick, but I've not grabbed a hamster in my mouth, so I can't be sure. Maybe I would if I had a bigger mouth. But hamsters have sharp teeth. Yes?
I think it probably does play the same role because I've seen it actually with bunnies, like little babies.
Rabbits definitely have it, yeah. And you can elicit in a rabbit just by, if the rabbit is very frightened and you just turn it over, and it's, we call it playing possum because possums are well known to do this when caught by a predator. And it often succeeds for the opossum. How do they decide, though, when to suddenly wake up and run away? That's the other fixed action pattern I'm talking about. It has a couple of components. First of all, they have to open their eyes periodically and look. What do they have to see to keep them frozen and playing dead? They have to see two eyes. As you know, predators have forward-facing eyes. The non-predators often have eyes for panoramic vision, more on the side of their head. So often you only see one eye at a time. A hamster is a little bit in between, because a hamster can be a predator with insects, things. He needs to have some ability to look with both eyes, and so he has eye movements, he can converge them, and he has eyes facing at 60 degrees from the straight ahead, okay, and 30 degrees up. So if you look at him from above, you see the two eyes. So if he looks in the right direction, he can use two eyes at once. But anyway, for the little chick, now getting back to the chick, if he sees two eyes, he simply closes his eye again and stays frozen. But if he doesn't, if he sees only one eye, he assumes it's not the predator. Or if he sees no eyes, he assumes it's not the predator. And so he wakes himself up and runs away. I'm sure mistakes are occasionally made, but usually it works. And these two fixed action patterns have protected many small birds from being killed by the predator. That's right.
But would there be animals where animals can kill another group of species?
Yeah, that's a good question. You do have intra-species killing occasionally, but it's generally not at all like situations where humans do it. You're talking about genocidal action in particular. And where you see killing, for example, in hamsters, is both males and females will do it, although it's usually the male fighting with other males in territory. When the weaker animal cannot escape, okay, that's a big mistake people will make sometimes, keeping caged animals, because they'll put them in a situation where one animal cannot escape from the other one, and one animal will get killed. It doesn't always happen if they're litter mates and they've been together since the time of their birth. Sometimes they will be able to live with each other. I've actually observed all of this myself. So what I did when I didn't have enough cages and I had to house them in pairs, I would put a wire hoop that was big enough so the one animal could jump up on top of the hoop. And if the other animal came up there, he would go below the hoop. And yeah, it kept him busy, but he could avoid being killed. So they have to be to get away. That's the more common situation. Generally, of course, we talked about ritualized fighting as one way to avoid damage. The other way is simply for escape. And generally, the animal will not pursue the animal forever. It happens in big, among the big apes too, and gorillas. Occasionally an animal will get killed, but usually he will get chased for a while, but then the winner will be recognized by the whole group as being dominant now, and the other will, within a few hours, be accepted as a subordinate by the animal that defeated him. I think to answer your question sufficiently, though, we'd have to look at chimpanzee behavior and see There are wars among groups of chimpanzees. That was discovered only after all the initial work by Jane Goodall, where she focused on some groups and didn't observe many encounters with other groups. And in fact, they first observed these chimpanzee wars when She first observed chimpanzee wars when she wasn't there at the Gombe Stream Reserve, and it was reported to her. She had a lot of difficulty even believing it, because she thought she sort of idealized chimps for a while, but then she's a good scientist, became realistic, did studies of it, and found out that they do have wars, and one group can completely annihilate another one. So whether all of those were fighting, I don't think so. I think they do actually kill the young and everybody. So we may have inherited some of that from some common ancestor. At least it's a possibility. These things are difficult to deal with. That's why some people don't like animal behavior studies. Okay, see you next time.